Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. We are so happy that you are joining us. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy. Oftentimes, in fulfilling a university mission that supports and drives national development, what happens in the process is making sense out of the world that we live in, pioneering solutions to challenges, and preparing for our best future. That is the power of higher learning. And that is how what may seem as lofty goals actually feed into the everyday aspects of our lives. On this episode of University Drive, our discussion is under the umbrella of science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, imagining new outcomes and how do we fill the space with our human capital, like the members of the University of the Bahamas community of scholars, faculty, and researchers. Our special guests are Dr. Desiree Cox, Rhodes Scholar, medical doctor, creative, and thought leader, it said, in future health and regenerative medicine. Dr. Cox, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we also have one of our favorites, Dr. Craig Smith, one of the professors at University in the Bahamas in the School of English Studies. Craig Smith, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Ms. Lundy. And thank you for not listing off all of Dr. Cox's accomplishments, because it would make me feel very small. So thank you.
Make you feel small? I don't think so. Okay, so Dr. Cox, this is your very first time as a guest on University Drive, as far as I'm aware. So we're looking forward to this conversation. Tell us what has been occupying your attention in the professional realm. I am familiar with some of the things that you've been involved in, but not all of them. And it's been a minute since I've heard you on the airwaves. So tell us, bring us up to speed.
Hi, yes, thank you very much for the question. And I'm going to keep that. I'm going to have to summarize that because I've been up to a lot and I'm continuing to be up to a lot. So let me just share, I suppose, the areas of my work. I consult to the Bahamas government, the Ministry of Health, in the area of stem cell, regenerative medicine, future health. And that takes the form of chairing the National Stem Cell Ethics Committee, and which is now the Joint National Stem Cell Ethics Committee and National Medical Ethics Committee, and shaping the regulatory oversight component of future health research that is not just stem cells, but a range of different areas around that, and ensuring that there is this bridge between safety, efficacy, and a bridge between university, commercial, international, and local healthcare practitioners. So there's a kind of umbrella that all fits into, and that takes various forms. The gift of COVID and many other trends is that much of that can be done virtually. So I'm based both in the U.S. and the Bahamas, and we're in a world where that is possible. And that's one umbrella of my world. The other thing that I do is I'm CEO of a biotech company, a research and development company that is U.S.-based or U.S.-registered. That company, bizarrely, and it's bizarre that we can do it in this part of in this time, is in the process of creating what is called a stem cell-based biologic. And I can say a bit more about that if people want to know more about that. that we're looking to take through the FDA process. It's an internationally based team in five different time zones. All of our work is virtual, and we partnered with various laboratories and agencies and components to create that product. So that keeps me connected to the day-to-day reality of making new medicines in our time, so that when you're sitting back from a regulatory point of view, you're not thinking just from policy or conceptual ideas. You're actually very attuned to the challenges, the barriers, the limitations. You're also attuned to who the players are in the field, who the good actors are, who the bad actors are. But that really complements my Bahamas regulatory oversight and work with the Ministry of Health, because I'm not imagining who these people are. I know who they are. I know what the FDA is saying on various things. I know what the trends are. I know what the thinking is in the field. I know what the limitations on the manufacturer are, and what the strengths around manufacturing. And that really allows us to, within the committee, which is international, do deep due diligence that is relevant to our time, which is so important for this advancing front of medicine. So that's the second bucket. The third thing that I do is I'm a adjunct professor, or I think you call them affiliate faculty member of Rutgers University, which is based in New Jersey. That's the biomedicine department. And one of the things I do there is I lecture the students who are on this journey, the next future health workforce, on in a course called Molecules to Medicine. And I do the last lecture at the end of that term, where they've already learned all the different pieces. And it's a 90-minute lecture where we pull all the pieces together. And they get to ask questions from someone who's doing that every day. And they found that quite helpful. And I find it a real gift to contribute. The other thing that I do in my professional umbrella is I am CEO, founder of this HealLink, which is what brings us here, or part of what brings us here. And we do a summit, an international summit, Future Health Innovation Summit. It started in 2018. That was the first one. We had another one in 2019. We paused in 2020 for all of the reasons that many things paused. And this is the third year. This is the fifth year of our existence, and this is going to be our third summit coming up April 17th to 19th at Atlantis Paradise Island. And we'll talk about that more in the program. The final piece of the puzzle for me is art and creativity. So I remain a professional artist. I see myself as a professional artist. I have been painting since 20 for the last 15 plus years, and my art shows all over the world. I'm just finishing and coming out of an exhibition in Atlanta that ended about 2 weeks ago, and I have another one coming up in New York in August. And we will also have an exhibition, a group exhibition, as a part of the summit. So that combination of components of creating this next paradigm of health is what constitutes my world, my professional world. And I do sleep 8 hours a night, and so I still get my sleep. And I think that wraps it up in terms of what I've been up to.
So, Dr. Cox, I have a really burning question for you, and that is, when are you going to share this cloning machine with us? Sounds like you're involved in a whole lot.
I think, I'm the sort of person, everyone, you've got to know how you're made. And I've always been intensely curious. I've always been someone who is active in a whole number of fronts and very sort of polymath-like in the way my brain and mind works. And so I realized that I need those pieces. I need to be active in those ways. That's how I'm made, and it brings joy to me. But what I find also, and that's why I encourage people who have these many different components of themselves, is very quickly the pieces connect. The dots all connect. There is a reason we are all made the way that we are, with the sensibilities and the interests that we have. And they may look separate because we have created a fragmented way of seeing the world, but they're actually, there's a way in which they live in harmony in each of us, and they are, the fullness of them is the expression of why we're here, how we contribute to the story of life, and how we contribute to all around us. So I always say the game is to find the way to be in the dance with all of these things without being overwhelmed. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. And when it's not working, your question is, which of the balls have you got to drop? Which things have got to be parked in order for other things to grow? And if you're me, you also need to do the self-talking that says, it's okay, they're there, it's okay, it's okay. You're going to be able to pick that up again. The time will be right, and your intuition will guide you as to when's the right time to reactivate that project. So that's my 5 cents on how to do it,
I get
as
it.
best I know.
I get it. So we've referred to future health, and we've also referred to regenerative medicine. And we know today that perhaps more than ever before, today, lots more people are paying active attention to their health. At least I feel like that's the case. That's one of the impacts of really living through a pandemic, eh? What do we mean by regenerative health? What do we mean by future health? What are we talking about in layman's terms?
It's a very, very fantastic question. The best way to do this is also to be historical. So we are at a time when there's not been a time like this ever before, but the last time that we had a new pillar of medicine, and one, it's important to see regenerative medicine, stem cell, longevity as a new pillar of medicine. The last time we had that was about 100 years ago, when we had the early beginnings of what we now see as biomedicine, and we had the beginnings of what would grow into big pharma and the pharmaceutical industry. Around that time, so we're going, let's go back to 100 years ago, which would take us into just before the First World War. Around the time of the First World War, we, because of diplomatic relations being suspended, a lot of our ways of standardizing the chemical products that would be the basis of pharmaceutical products, those relations broke down, and it meant that the standards could not be traded. What that led to was the creation of what we now, for scientists, will understand, the scientists and academics will get this, biological standard. We had to create then biological models for diseases, biological standards. It's around the interwar period between the First and Second World War that starts to happen. Around that time and after that, we have the first clinical trial, which is our way, our randomized trial, which is a way of knowing whether a therapeutic works or not. You divide the treatments into one group, placebo group, or another group that is getting the treatment. You find a way of randomizing it, and then based on that, you're able to tell whether that works. All of those things are foundational to what comes to be the pharmaceutical industry and getting safe medicines out. So that was 100 years ago. Why this time is so important, and we've got an umbrella that we call regenerative medicine, longevity technology. That's what we're putting it as a bucket into. But why it's so important is it has been 100 years since we had a new pillar of medicine that is changing the whole game of what health, science, and medicine looks like. That pillar is based on a philosophy that says we know that we have in our bodies the ability to regenerate, rejuvenate, to heal ourselves. Our cells, the cellular biology has the ability to do that. We have gotten better and increased our science through our scientific knowledge to know how to understand the genome. We've been able to we will likely by the end of this year be able to sequence everyone's genome for about $100, which is phenomenal. Now it'll cost more to be able to interpret that data, but that's where we're at in terms of what we can do. We understand the genetics and we have gotten better at understanding how the cells work. We know that in the course of a lifetime, the stem cells, which are these cells that can become any other part of the body that it needs to be when necessary, that circulate through the body, decline over time. And so that started to make people kind of interested in how they could increase the number of circulating stem cells in the body to nudge the body, let's say, towards its own rejuvenation. But that's only a tiny part of it. Why this looks like a new pillar of medicine is in order for that to happen, for that to be realized, we've got the digital health component. So we've had an explosion in digital health. We've got artificial intelligence. We've got deeper knowledge, a lot of data that helps us understand personalized medicine so that our bodies are not are individually the way they are. Each of us is different. And each of us has our own algorithm, our own master algorithm for how we work. So this new phase of medicine, this new paradigm is about bringing together these philosophies that say, hey, we have the ability to regenerate our health. One. Two, we have the ability to, through our knowledge, to manage all sorts of aspects of our health. We're increasingly, for women, we will be able to control and manage when we ovulate, how we ovulate. That will have implications for our longevity because female health and female ovarian health are connected to longevity. We have other aspects of our longevity that we will be able to control and manage so that we can live longer, better. And that's what this whole new pillar of medicine that people are so excited about is about. And it offers massive opportunities, a whole range of interdisciplinary opportunities beyond doctors, scientists, for all of us to be a part of that. So that's what stem cell regenerative medicine is about, why I'm excited about it, and why the summit has come into being in the Bahamas is many of us and our ancestors were not a part of creating the story, the narrative around the new paradigm of health. We inherited that. We were not at the table and therefore probably in many cases on the menu. Why I'm excited and think this is such an important time is it's an opportunity for us to bring diverse voices into the creation of this new paradigm so that all voices, all kinds of opinions are a part of shaping this new narrative. And to do that, you have to be able to sit in the room and understand and take in what's really going on, where the changes are, where the knowledge are, and how to connect the dots for yourself around this new story of wellness.
Health is where it's at, and not to be cliche, but health is truly wealth. You've said a lot of things, and certain things you said, it made me think of Dr. Craig Smith. You're talking about diverse voices, and I'm thinking about having those critical conversations for really enduring change. And that is something that Craig Smith has been a champion of. And you also talked about having the pieces fit together. So how does the collaboration between yourself and Dr. Smith fit together? Enter
Yeah,
Craig
absolutely.
Smith
So,
and enter Craig Smith. Let's get you in on this.
yes. So Craig had come to the second summit in 2019. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and we got together. We sat down many months ago when this was the summit was being planned, and we had this conversation, which we share a passion around Bahamian students, Bahamian citizens and residents being a part of these opportunities that come to the country. And so I said to him, can you work with me on trying to get University of the Bahamas faculty and students involved? I want to find ways. We had tried this from 2018, and we have a component of the summit that links the science, technology, engineering, math, young people from 15 to 17, embeds them into the summit. But I had not managed to bridge that yet into the college students. And so when college students are looking at what they will study, how it fits in, we want to find a way to bring them into that conversation. And that started various things. And so I'll turn it over to Craig to jump in and speak about the work we've been doing in this together in this run up to the summit.
Okay, so can you hear me?
We can take it
Okay.
away.
All right, so I mean, I have to say that I met Dr. Cox several years ago because I actually ended up going to the summit. I think it was in 2019. I wasn't aware of it, but the mutual colleague that she mentioned, she actually flew to the Bahamas to attend this conference, and she told me about it. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay, yeah, well, I would be interested to go. And I attended, and it was just amazing the diversity of the voices that were there. There were people from all over the globe here at in the Bahamas and talking about these issues that we are all interested in, but I think many of us maybe weren't aware of. One of the things that surprised me while I was there was that there were high school students in attendance, being a part of the conversation. And I mean, these high school students were brilliant. They were asking great questions. They were engaging in conversation. And at the time, I wondered where were the University of the Bahamas students, and there weren't any around. And so that was something that piqued my interest. And so when I met Dr. Cox and we started talking, and she mentioned that one of her goals is to get this information out to Bahamians in general, so Bahamians in general know that this is something that is happening and is available for them, but specifically wanting to reach out to our university students. These are people who will be making the future, right? These are future doctors and nurses and business people and journalists and, and so for her, it was really important that we bring in university students. And for me as well, I thought that that was really important. And so we spoke, and I figured I would do what I can in order to spread the word to the university faculty and students, and do what I can to ensure that they are at least aware of what is happening and they are able to attend. One of the great things about this conference for Bahamians in general is it's very affordable, right? Because Dr. Cox can speak specifically about the pricing. I believe it's above $400 for international registrants, but for local registrants, it's only $100 for Bahamians. And so that is a great incentive for Bahamians to come out to the conference. But one of the things that I thought about was, again, in terms of thinking about our students and understanding that, our students' finances may be limited. So Dr. Cox was able to come up with a program to offer scholarships for our university students. And so I think it's up to 20 or 30 students who are interested in attending the conference, they can actually attend the conference for free. And so they have access to all this information. They're able to network with people within the field, those students who are about to graduate. It may be a great way to make connections for future opportunities. And so I think it's really important that we get this message out and we get this message out to students. And also, not just nursing students or science students or our medical students, but also students in other fields as well. One of the things that Dr. Cox pointed out is that she is also an artist, right? And so thinking about how in these other fields, we also connect with the medical field as well. I think one of the art professors here, Kishan Monroe, is always talking about the connection between art and science, because oftentimes when these scientists come up with this information, they're the people in the art world are the people who can translate that into messages that people can readily understand, right? So someone like me who's in school of English, right? They need people to be able to break down the scientific jargon into ways that people understand, or even visually, and people for our art students and so on. In terms of thinking about the future of the medical field and the things that Dr. Cox was talking about, these are new opportunities for businesses. And so our business students should be a part of it. There are ways, again, our communication students need to be a part of it because they will need to be able to disseminate information as well. Since Dr. Cox and I spoke, we have arranged two Zoom sort of informational sessions. The last one focused on law and the areas in law that will open up in opportunities for our young lawyers. So across the university, there are opportunities for all of our students. And I think that that's really an important thing for us to get across, that it's not just, we may hear stem cell and we think, oh, they're talking about science, or they're talking about nursing, or they're talking about doctors, but it's an open field. It's a burgeoning area for all sorts of potential. And I think that that's really important for our students to understand. And they should be interested to come out and, just hear about the kinds of opportunities that are available and to network and to meet some of these very important people within the field.
So, in what you both have said, I am hearing we're talking about knowledge, existing knowledge, probing that knowledge, questioning that knowledge, and evolving that knowledge, as well as creating new knowledge. And there is a space and place, absolutely, for University of the Bahamas in that. One of the roles that you have, Dr. Cox, is in that as the head of that National Stem Cell Ethics Committee. I haven't really heard a lot of conversation about stem cell of late as it relates to the Bahamas, but when you think about our existing reality, having with us having just dealt in a major way, the world that is with this pandemic, at the intersection of regenerative health, stem cells, and infectious diseases, what is it that we need to pay attention to?
Oh yeah, thank you very much for that. So it's interesting, the peak of interest around stem cell regenerative medicine in the Bahamas. If we just talk a little bit about that, we had the laws in 2013 and 2014. The first ethics committee convened in 2015. And since then, and more recently, we meet once a month to review new applications. And there have been at least 700 patients who have been treated with stem cells in the Bahamas since this happened, since the laws began. We've had a first-in-man study in the Bahamas that has been extremely successful. It happened a few years back with five patients who have been followed for the past 2 years and have been out. They were older patients because this was more an aging frailty that they were in. They're still alive. we were interested in how they fared during COVID. They two of them got COVID, recovered extremely well, and we've been able to look at what was going on with their immune profile in the process. So that is so we've had patients who've been treated who've benefited from that. Many of them, about 80%, I would say, would be your medical tourism cases. But we've always been interested, and we've always had a requirement of two things: that each of these companies must partner with a Bahamian doctor in order to what is called the principal investigator, a co-principal investigator that is Bahamian, and each and wherever possible should involve Bahamian nurses in the team involved in that. One. Two, we've also required that they produce some sort of guidance around special opportunity and pricing for Bahamians who might be in need. And we require that, and they do that. But we at the same time know that many Bahamians will not think it's for them, will not know enough about it, might not be interested about it. So that also has been for me a driver around setting up HealLink, setting up this conference. It's not a government enterprise. It's a private thing that I set up outside of that, so that there's not that component of it. Its role is exposure, education, connect, mentorship, opportunity, so that it's outside of that realm, and it can therefore deliver that the opportunity and really expose people to what's going on globally, but what is also relevantly happening in country, so that people can understand that. And Dr. Craig mentioned something very important about all the other people involved in this burgeoning industry. So people need to get past whatever strange idea they may have had about what a stem cell is and why it's not for them, and the initial early adopters of new methods are often colorful characters, and so people will have pictures in their minds about what that's like. So the translation of a new philosophy in medicine requires visuals, it requires consent forms. We always had consent forms for this, but we will always be asking people to simplify those consent forms so anyone can understand. And so the way to see stem cell regenerative medicine is not that it's something outside of all of normal wellness. If in fact we're saying, this, and we are saying that the cells in our bodies are this kind of information machine, that actually what we're doing all the time, whether it's through yoga, whether it's through creative arts, whether it's through behavior change, whether it's through food, we're in a process of feeding the cells information. So it's information. The cells are guided by information. You can see when a virus, for instance, goes into a cell, see it as a kind of USB jump drive that jacks into the cell and feeds the cell information, and thus co-opts that cell and has that cell do its own bidding. So it's a different way of seeing the body and seeing that if what we are and what we're driven by is information, and the cells are being programmed with different information, this is a new way of seeing the world. So this kind of therapeutic or this kind of aspect of medicine will affect all areas of the body. And we broke the body into these different systems and organs. And so we've got our hepatic liver conferences and our brain conferences and our kidney disease conferences. But that is not who we are. We are whole, interconnected beings.
And that's all very intriguing. And I can just hear that Craig Smith has an intervention as well.
Why this is so timely, and I think it's really important for us in the Bahamas and in the Caribbean in general, actually, because the other day I was listening, partially listening to Dr. Hilary Beckles, who's charging the reparations committee within the Caribbean. And one of the things that he spoke about was the way in which the transatlantic slave trade change our physiology, our biology in certain ways. And so he talks about the fact that people in the New World, Black people in the New World, you know, we suffer from all these diseases, and even the drugs that they've come up with to, you know, combat hypertension, high blood pressure, all these other things, they don't necessarily work in the same ways on people within the Caribbean in particular. And so I'm really interested in, again, thinking about the future medicine and thinking about the type of research that this summit is going to focus on. I'm actually really interested as a Black man in the Caribbean in terms of how this work might be able to sort of, you know, help us with that particular issue. I don't know if that's something Dr. Cox has heard or is working on, but I feel like that is something very sort of significant for me as a Caribbean person and why I'm really interested to see what this research and where this work might lead to, you know?
This is actually a very good spot for us to take our break. You're listening to University Drive. We'll be back after this.
Chapter One Bookstore is your back-to-school headquarters. We are proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our coffee center throughout the semester for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael Eldon Complex. Call us at 397-2650 or email us at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. See you soon.
We're back here on University Drive. We're talking about creating the next paradigm of health, regenerative health. We have as our guest, Dr. Desiree Cox. Before the break, Craig Smith made an intervention concerning really applicability, I would say. You know, sometimes we have these old medical remedies that we've come up with to really treat mass populations, but it might not necessarily work when we're talking about people of color or people with different characteristics. What is your response to what he just shared with us?
Yeah, Dr. Smith makes an excellent and extremely important and timely point, and it is very much about precisely why I have been passionate about Bahamians and the medical community and the research community and the future researchers, business people, scientists, artists being involved in this conversation. It's precisely right on point. One thing that I am hoping and my aspiration for the summit, and was why one of the reasons for setting it up, pardon me, I had gone to the World Stem Cell Summit on many occasions, or a couple of occasions before then, and I looked at that and I thought, there needs to be a platform that is specifically focused on activating the ecosystems of places that have not been traditionally a part of the conversation that shaped the existing paradigm, that got in on the back foot, or were the people that that the medicines were meant to be for, but they weren't a part of the process of creating those medicines. And you know, there's that expression, it takes a village to raise a child. It's an equivalent for it in creating a new discourse in medicine and new medicine. It takes a whole ecosystem to do that. And so I wanted to have this platform be deliberately located in the places where there is the emergent economies the Bahamas representative of that of the region, kind of spreading into the region, the international people coming into that space to be a part of the local conversation. And I will be announcing at this year's summit the places that the summit will be also operating in from 2024 onwards because of these 5 years of readiness of the prototype. But that part was critical because of what Dr. Smith mentioned, which is when drugs, medicines get created, and even when the new medicines are being created, in many cases, there's been a standard man, 70 kilogram man, usually Caucasian origin. The models that we've used have tended to be male models. It was really only in about 1997, around that time, that it was required by the NIH, which is the largest funding body in the world, that women should be included in clinical trials. Up to that point, it was entirely possible for you to do clinical trials with only men on new medicines. And eight out of the 10 medicines that were pulled from the pulled from existence around 2000 were medicines that had larger than normal adverse effects, impacts on women. Okay, so that's an example of the way in which, by excluding certain segments of the population, you can steer and create a medical system that is not designed for them, and a medical system that does not produce a therapeutics that is necessary in their best interest. More recently, in 2016, it has been in 2016 that the NIH now requires that female mice are included in all of the, when you're doing the biomedical baseline laboratory-based research, that you must include female mice or other animals in that work. Because what that has meant, and we're going a bit deep on the science side of things, but it's necessary to do that to speak to Dr. Craig's point, what's meant, and we're staying with the female gender, what that's meant is that the very foundation by around which you create a new medicine, on which you test the hypothesis of whether it's one of the new regenerative medicines or not, whether you test the hypothesis of how it works, means that if you were only using animals with a male physiology, you were missing key components of that. So it's only now that it's required in 2016 that you have to use a female mice. So when we look at this new shift and including all voices and including the realization that our bodies are different, Dr. Craig mentioned the body of a Black male. The bodies are different. Our bodies are also shaped by our environment. So there's an environmental impact on why and how our bodies are different. We know that is under the umbrella of epigenetics. The epigenetic profile for how we are will change depending on the time of day. Some of these changes are reversible, will depend on where on the earth we live. It will depend on many different aspects of our external surrounding environment. So this is also going to be an opportunity, this summit, for a number of projects that have been started in the US in which people are keeping databases of different kinds of genetic profiles and genetic platforms in order to make sure that research is speaking to and comes out from, grows out from the different ways that we are made, the different genetic profiles that we have. So we're not looking to fit, shoehorn some one-size-fit-all solution into the individual ways that we are, but we are looking to create from the ground up with a full appreciation of how we are, which means at University of the Bahamas, University of the West Indies, locally based universities where people are doing research can make that research more relevant, directly relevant to the populations and the communities they serve. And we can do that from the most basic science up through collaboration with international institutions and international databases so that we are creating things that are relevant, directly relevant for us. That
and as we starts, and as we bring these diverse plethora of voices together.
Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. starts with networking. That starts with being in the room. That starts with understanding the conversation. That starts to reaching out with to the person who gave that talk that just triggered something in your mind about research that you've always wanted to do, and you want might want to know whether that's possible to partner with them or whether they know someone. That starts with being in these conversations where there's open-mindedness, there's an open attitude for collaboration and creating the new world in a way that is good for all of us.
You hinted at factors external to the body, and I want to pick up that train of thought. When we're thinking about, and I'm going to inject my layman's perspective here, but we're talking about stem cells, and in my view, they are our secret weapons because of their regenerative capacity and capability and abilities, right? So a lot of the conversations on a national level have also related to what we put into our bodies, the kinds of foods that we eat, natural versus
absolutely
non-genetically modified and everything else in between, right? And so the question that I have is, as we talk about this new this growing philosophy, this new area, this new paradigm that's taking shape, what are the conversations that need to happen in respect of what we put into our bodies that can help our stem cells to sustain themselves, to survive, and to thrive? What are the things that we need to be paying attention to as we reach out to members of the public who may not have this elevated insight and knowledge?
What we know is we have actionable, there's actionable data that we have that we have tended and are not always acting on, but that data still remains some of the most fundamental and important things that we can do to live better longer. You mentioned food. We know food is medicine. That is absolutely the case. It is increasingly clear that the way of stemming the flow of chronic disease, of dealing with chronic disease, falls into two main components. One, which is lifestyle medicine, that is actionable data that we can act on, must act on, that it is clearly demonstrated has a strong impact on reducing chronic disease. That is something that every one of us can do. You don't need to know the first thing about stem cells to act on that, and that is proven. One, so that is lifestyle medicine, which includes food, diet, exercise, and also behavioral change, behavioral modification. One, that's one arm. The other arm are the therapeutics that reduce metabolic, reduce and or reverse metabolic damage. So coming back to that first pillar, which is something that every one of us can do that you mentioned, is food. We know that without going to the details of genetically modified food, we know that much of the food that people that we will eat, that we will buy in the store, is really not food. That we know that much of that does not have the micronutrients in it So we need to find, we need to move towards food that has the micronutrients in it. We know that we are better off when we are growing our own food. That is not always possible, but it is when our ancestors would grow the fruit on the tree, you would not pick the fruit off the tree until it was ripe. Now, why is that important? Because at the point of the ripening of the fruit is when all of those micronutrients are there. When you pick the fruit green and you package it or you spray it and it looks really pretty and it gets into your food store and it's already hard as a rock, that apple is, but it looks pretty. And it was picked very young, it was picked before time in order to stand the travel, etc. You're often not getting the best nutrients from food. So first of all, choice of food, all the evidence is showing that the more that we can move towards greens and towards what would be a more of a raw or vegan or green diet, the more anti-inflammatory, that's a more anti-inflammatory diet. So, and not one who's going to say, don't eat meat, don't eat this, blah, blah, blah. Our bodies are different and we will, you know, our glucose will spike at different times when, depending on what we eat. There was somebody showed me some data recently that showed the glucose spiking more when the person had a banana than when they had a cookie. I mean, go figure. That probably is the only person in the world whose glucose spiked.
Wow.
Yeah, but it just goes that we are different. So, but there are some general things that are reasonably general truths that we can hold, which is the more anti-inflammatory our diet is, the better off we are. The more that we are eating greens and fruit and vegetables, the better we are. The more that we can lean towards growing our own food or having food that is coming from the organic markets or the markets where you know you can trace where that food started from, farm to table, the more we are. So it's more a question, given that we live a modern life, that it's what can we do more of that steers us towards health and less of that steers us away. We know that if we have preservatives, if we can avoid that, we're better off. We also know that many of the things that go as healthy green snacks are like vegan junk food. You know, so we know that all of those things are standard pieces of knowledge that we can follow as much as we possibly can. Exercise, we know there's a strong correlation between exercise throughout life and longevity. That should be at least 3 times a day, but some minimal amount of exercise, 30 minutes is the standard amount every day is incredible. If you can only walk, that is better than nothing. So it's often for many people in steering the ship towards, you know, the lifestyle medicine that we know to do, you might only be able to do one small chunk of that at a time. You may not be able to do all of it at a time. But if you can just steer more towards the stuff that we know, leaves you, keeps you in the area of wellness, and not beat yourself up about the things that you're still doing that are not so great for wellness, that's a right start. And then you start to tweak and turn the system more towards wellness. So that's the what you're putting into the body. But let us not forget that it's also about how quality of life is also how we're living. Living in a stress-based environment, you're furious at everyone, your rage and anger is through the roof. All of that is going to affect yourself. That is going to affect the environment that your mind body is living in, and that lives in the cells. So you also, that's where what Dr. Craig does in terms of mindfulness, meditation, that's why all of those things matter. They all come together. They all have a biological, mental, and physiological component towards wellness. So those are things that everyone can do. for helping us live better, longer.
So paying attention to the full complexities of health and wellness, that's important. I want to change directions for a moment. As I talked to you during the show, I was imagining the realm of professional competencies that are needed and how higher education mm-hmm. plays such a vital role in bridging that gap. How did you, Desiree Cox, venture into this realm even as a young student in university? You said that you've always been intensely yeah. curious, and I can tell. Yeah. I can tell.
Yeah, so it started for me like, it was not a traditional way that I ended up on this path. I was, there are many different touch points to that story, but two touch points jump out for me. Well, maybe three that I'll touch on that will be the people will probably, hopefully people will relate to. One, I was a kid in the Bahamas. My people from, you know, southern Bahamas. I was the first in my family, in my nuclear family, to go to university. Nobody had gone to university before. I had a mother who was passionate about education and really saw education as the key for her girls to be able to stand on their own two feet, command their, chart their future. And so I'm lying on the floor with one of my schoolmates in high school with my legs dangling in the air doing my homework. And she is an Indian girl whose father was a doctor. And she was at my school and she was about to do the Oxford and Cambridge exams. And so she pulled out this brochure with the Oxford students walking around on the lawns. And I looked at that and I was like, I want to go there. It was something about it. The fact that it looked beautiful, but also it had there that, you know, the top people in the world, that was where knowledge got created and the best of the best discussed things. And that's where the best of the best learned about what was next and et cetera. And I thought, that is where I want to go. And she said, well, you can't go there because you need to do a special exam to go there. And I was like, okay, I'll do the exam. She's like, well, you can't just do the exam. You have to apply to do the exam, and a special examiner has to come down from England to administer the exam. I said, well, I can do it. Well, you can't do that because it requires a special curriculum. So after she listed all those barriers, I started to see that, yeah, maybe I wouldn't be able to do it now. But I just said to her, I'll meet you there. And I saw myself at Oxford, with no obvious external way in which I would get there. It was certainly beyond the price range. And I had only just barely heard of it. So certainly my family had not. So I got to, you know, McGill was my first degree. I'd gotten several scholarships. I had two musical concerts to save money, and that got me to McGill. And when I was at McGill, my prof in my last year said, well, you know, there's this scholarship that's around for Oxford. He mentioned Rhodes. I did hear Rhodes, but I didn't really hear, all I heard was Oxford. I'm like, this is your chance. And so I got my scholarship. I studied quantum mechanics at McGill. I got my scholarship, the scholarship for the Rhodes for Oxford. I go to Oxford, and this is the second pivot point. I go to Oxford Medical School. I had the first 2 years of medical school, all perfectly fine. And then in the first year of the clinical years, in the first semester, I was sitting in the waiting room, in the lobby, where all the patients are waiting for their ride, and they're walking around with their drips and their gowns half open, you know, the embarrassing ways that you look in hospitals, you know, you're not at your best. And I'm looking at them walking around, and I have this clear sense that the medicine that we are practicing is so primitive. Now, I am at Oxford. I'm at that place, the best of the best. I am at one of the top institutions in the world for medicine in the region. And I am a baby whippersnapper. I'm barely able to diagnose a common cold at that stage in my training. And so the temerity to claim that the medicine that we were practicing was primitive when I was, you know, barely a student to understand it, was not something I dared say very often to people, but it absolutely possessed me. And it drove me throughout my entire clinical years to divide my world into two parts. One, 4:30 in the morning to 8:45 when I was on the wards was when I read philosophy, history, medical anthropology. I was reading to try and refine my question. There was some question, I knew this instinct that what we were doing was primitive, was just the surface of something else. And I spent my whole clinical years researching, going to lectures in the evenings, and doing my medical school training with all the other doctors to try and refine my questions. So by the time as medical school was over, which is what led to me doing my master's and my PhD at Cambridge, I had my question. And my question was, how did we get the medicine that we currently have? How did we get that? How did we get it? Why does it look like that? And I had the sense that if you could work that out, you could reverse engineer how to get a medicine that was more connected, more whole, and more advanced. And trust me when I tell you, because this was way, I finished medical school 30 years ago, just to give you an instinct, okay? At that time, this was not a conversation you could have within medicine very often. It was rare that you could find someone. It was not something that people were willing to entertain. And so I did my PhD looking at the things that shape this current medicine. When my PhD was over, and I then specialized in psychiatry, I was still holding in my heart a way to be part of and to be a leader of, because I'm ambitious, a leader of the next paradigm of medicine. And I had no idea how. So I was walking that path of knowing what I wanted to see, not even fully knowing how you would get there or that it would look like stem cell and regenerative medicine. But I had the clarity of what was needed. And then the first opportunity I got to jump off that traditional medical pathway and use all those many degrees I had to shape a path that was right for me, a path that would be allow me to contribute with the fullness of myself, my fullness of my being, which was around 2000, was what I did that. So I tell you all of that in terms of how I got there, which is why I'm so passionate about these kids, these students, the young kids, seeing and touching that which they cannot yet even fully define, that which is, you know, the over the bridge, over the rainbow. Why I'm so passionate about them touching it is I first touched it, saw it on a magazine, and then followed that kind of internal North Star. So if you can get close to that which is just growing, which is just burgeoning, it will pique your, I want it to pique their imagination so that they create way beyond what we as the adults who will be giving the talks and the presenting and the in the labs and in the universities, way beyond what we can currently see. But first, you need to get close enough to the fire to see those sparks and let it ignite something internal within you and follow your instinct as to where that goes. You've no idea where it'll go, but trust me, it will get you to that place where you start to feel like you are fully resting in your being, like you are doing exactly what you are on this planet to do, even if you don't have all of the words to define it.
Thank you for sharing your personal story. I believe in there are nuggets to inspire and encourage people who have goals and aspirations for themselves, especially our young people, those in university and colleges who see themselves as part of something bigger, and also individuals who want to build and uplift. We have exactly 1 minute left. Tell us again about this Future Health Summit.
So, www.healinc.com. It starts on Monday, the 17th of April, and goes on till Wednesday, the 19th of April. you will be able to find, as a Bahamian citizen and resident, the opportunity to have a unique pass, which is just for $100 for full access. Starts at 8:30. You will see the program schedule of when it starts and when it ends. If you are unable for some reason, you're busy at work, you have classes, you're not able to get there for the whole day on the Monday or the whole day on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, I would urge you to make sure you come to two things, or you feel even $100 is a lot. There are two free opportunities that you could come to. Come to the grand opening of the exhibition hall, the summit, which will also have a public lecture. The Minister of Health will be there. There'll be a drum solo there. There will be networking opportunities for you there. And that is all about mental health, quality of life, and the ecosystem. That is what the talk is about. That is from 5:30 on Monday to 7:30. Atlantis, Paradise Island is where it will be. When you come in, you will see all the signs directing you there. That's your first free opportunity. If you are a medical professional or aspiring to be a medical professional anywhere in the healthcare system, you would love to come to the stem cell grand round between 8 o'clock in the morning on the Wednesday, that's the third day, and 10:30. And you will see core lecturers there. And you will also be hearing from some of the Bahamians doctors who are in that Heal Inc. Summit.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a riveting discussion. I am sure that our listeners have been edified. I've been your host, Tamika Lundy. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us and listening to University Drive. We'll see you again next week, same time.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.